Space Oddity.
Hello and welcome to the new episode of Space Oddity. I'm Christopher and your introductory host for this episode. Today, you're listening to a conversation by Simon Pohl and Erik Letgemann with our visiting scholar Tanya Bosch from South Africa, recorded in June 2023. And together they're discussing the Roads Must Fall student protest case along new forms of social activism, and they're questioning if there is a directionality from digital space towards physical space, and how our queer spaces are represented on Instagram or TikTok in the South African context. And finally, what is about the decolonization of research and digital methods? Before joining the discussion, I'd like to present our three guests. And yeah, the visiting scholar Tanya Bosch visited us here in June 2023. And she's an associate professor of media studies and production at the Center for Film and Media Studies at the University of Cape Town. And her most recent book, Social Media and Everyday Life in South Africa, was published in 2021 by Routledge. And this year, the co-edited volume with Tony Roberts, Digital Citizenship in Africa, got published as open access via Bloomsbury. And before joining academia, Tanya Bosch was working in the local film and community radio sector, and her research interests are community radio, talk radio and citizenship, health communication, youth and mobile media, as well identity and social networking. And with her work on Roads Must Fall and Fees Must Fall, hashtag, she's also one of the few emerging African academics who are publishing in the area of the social media activism. And our two project researchers and other guests are Erik Letgemann, who is a postdoc researcher at the project BO4, Locative Media, and Simon Pohl is a pre-doc researcher at the project CO7, Platform Economy. So that's it for the introduction. Now we join together the discussion. Have fun.
I'm Tanya Bosch, and I'm based at the Center for Film and Media Studies at the University of Cape Town. Most of my research is really around social media. I'm really interested in exploring how people use social media for personal and also group identity formation. And I'm also quite interested in social media and activism, so how people have used people and groups as well, organizations and civil society organizations and looser networks of people have used social media for different forms of activism. And to me, that's just really interesting, especially in the South African context. You know, we have this huge history of political activism in South Africa. So I'm just really curious to see how people transition to online spaces to use social media platforms for that kind of political activism.
My name is Simon Pohl. I'm working at the CRC Refiguration of Spaces at the Technical University of Berlin. My project CO7 is concerned with Airbnb and spatial conflicts surrounding Airbnb. So basically, we look at how the space is translated to the network space of Airbnb, like the local places, how this affects local neighborhoods, what conflicts arise there, how the marketplace is organized, what's the difference between professional and non-professional users. Also, I'm doing my PhD right now, where I'm using a mix of topic modeling and multiple correspondence analysis to map out the marketplace and see what different kinds of groups of hosts there actually are.
My name is Erik Letgemann. I'm a postdoc researcher at the CRC's sub-project Locative Media. Locative Media is an umbrella term for all those digital media that use mobile devices and their positioning technologies to display to their users information about their current location in real time. Examples are Google Maps as a recommendation service, or mobile dating apps like Tinder, or gaming apps like Pokemon Go that superpose new meaning to physical spaces. And we look at these phenomena from a more qualitative sociological perspective. So we're doing ethnography, basically, and we are interested in the conflicts that accompany these changes.
First of all, thanks for being here. I really appreciate that. I would like to start a conversation with a little anecdote. When we visited you in Cape Town back in March, we were at a seminar of yours, and you had this one slide where you showed pictures from a protest in, I think, 2015.
Correct.
Yeah. And I was really curious about that because when we went to university, we always saw this big monument on the hillside, and we always wondered, what is this thing? Because it looks a bit like a big temple or something, and very sanctuous.
Yeah, some special monument.
Yeah, exactly.
Almost religious.
Exactly. And this lecture you held, you talked about that you did some research on that. So in the aftermath, I looked up some papers of yours and found this paper on Worlds Must Fall. And this especially for me is interesting because it shows how places and network spaces, as we call them in the CRC, are connected. How places impact the discussions in network spaces, and how these spaces and subspaces are actually formed. To start things off, I would ask you to just tell us a bit about what you found there and what your research objectives were.
Absolutely. So monuments are really interesting things. You have them all over the city in Berlin as well. I've been taking pictures of all the monuments. And monuments, statues, buildings that are commemorative are really interesting because they say something to us about the history of a place. Now, Cape Town, South Africa, as you know, has a history of colonialism, and Cape Town in particular has a strong history with slavery, colonialism, and also slavery, etc. So monuments of particular significance, I think, in the South African context, so South Africa seemed like we've started to change street names, we've changed names of airports, changed names of buildings, and you really see how things like monuments, especially when they're linked to an unpleasant past, a history, they are part of history, but they are part of a history that people want to try to shift or change, how that becomes quite significant. So the statue, the Rhodes Memorial, or the statue of Cecil John Rhodes, kind of famous colonialist who said various terrible things that I cannot remember offhand, but not a very well-liked character. There was obviously the statue on the campus of the university. And for many students, it made them feel really uncomfortable, and that goes back to this role that monuments and statues play in our societies and what they say about space, what kind of atmosphere they create in space. So the Rhodes Must Fall student protests at the University of Cape Town were really about the removal of the statue from the campus. But what was particularly interesting was the intersection with the digital and how these protests played out in a digital space, primarily on Twitter. So the formation of the hashtag Rhodes Must Fall became kind of the slogan of the movement. And I think what was super interesting to me, the paper that I published was really just about how students used the Twitter space to propel this network to, Twitter was kind of used as what Gabada refers to as a choreography of assembly, so as a way to publicize the protest, to publicize the offline action, but also as a way to make public the protest to the mainstream news media. So it also had a kind of PR purpose. And I think Rhodes Must Fall really shows that connection between the offline and the online, how online space, a hashtag, was used very much to facilitate offline political action.
So one key part of your paper I took away was actually that you discovered different clusters of TVM activity. And in the graph you put in your paper, you can see that there are these clusters and they are kind of clearly demarcated. So there's you can see that there are sub-communities and that people from different parts of the Twitterverse actually discuss this topic in different manners. And from a theoretical perspective from the CRC, this is really, really interesting because we perceive demarcation as a property of the territory, of the nation state and administrative units. This clearly shows that there's also this boundary work within the network space, which we perceive as primarily functioning as a way of connection.
Yeah, so absolutely. And I think that's really interesting because you think about Twitter or social media as being a kind of open space, a flatter kind of space. But again, you see the replication of the structures that you have in offline spaces, in online spaces. So when you looked at hashtag roads must fall, and you looked at kind of a network analysis of the conversations taking place among people and groups that were using that hashtag, you really saw a clear demarcation in terms of, you know, groups and subgroups. You had the news media, you had students, you had citizens. It was really quite clear to see quite a stark division in terms of kind of those groups. And in some ways, yes, they were connected by the hashtag. They were sometimes speaking to each other. But it was interesting to see also, I think, power dynamics emerge in that kind of space. So Twitter users gave a lot of power to the news media. The most retweeted tweets were tweets that were put out by news organizations, newspapers, television stations, and so on. You know, and that again kind of highlights that notion that people place faith in the news, in mainstream print news media. You know, so very much like that replication of the offline, what's happening in the offline world, you see very much in online spaces. I think this is particularly useful in South Africa, Global South context, because as you're aware, we have issues related to the digital divide. Not everyone is online. Not everyone is on Twitter. I think even in Global North spaces, you find that social spaces are frequented by a small group of people, or there's kind of that notion that you have a small group of people with big voices that are dominating the conversation, you know. And I think what's interesting here, when you look at kind of what was happening with Roads Must Fall, is that it allows you to build the argument that Twitter is actually quite a representative space. What I think is interesting is that you see quite clearly when you look at this Roads Must Fall case, how online phenomenon kind of replicates what's happening in the offline world. So even though we think of social media spaces as not being that representative because not everybody's online, at the same time, it seems like it somehow is quite representative. You have enough diversity of voices in the Twitter sphere, for example, to be able to make connections between what's happening in offline spaces.
Maybe to circle back to your previous talking point, you also mentioned that the conversation on Twitter online in the network space actually affected how people behaved in the offline world and in their physical behavior towards this topic and their demonstration behavior. Maybe could you dive into that a bit? Because from this talking point, it sounded a bit like there's a one-way direction from the physical space to the digital space.
Yeah, so kind of the digital to the offline. I think the digital is super powerful. There's that notion of things going viral in social media, and you really see the virality of whether it's hashtags or whether it's, you know, specific topics. And I think one of the arguments I make in that paper is about the agenda setting role of Twitter in particular. You know, I guess there's always that debate, like when we talk about the Arab Spring, for example, and people call them Twitter revolutions or Facebook uprisings. That's considered quite controversial because, of course, those protests would have happened without the platforms as well. You know, so there's always kind of that idea, would the protest have happened without it? And I think in the case of Roads Must Fall and then later also Fees Must Fall, those protests would have taken a very different nature without social media. In the case of Roads Must Fall, you definitely see a shift in the directionality of influence or power, so digital to the offline, where it played a role in terms of putting it on the agenda. It was coordinating people saying, so at the very last minute, you can't organize an illegal protest in advance because, of course, they'll shut it down if they know there's going to be a protest. But it was very easy to tweet 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, short periods of time, 30 minutes before, even up to 5 minutes before something was going to happen. Come to this place, bring placards that say such and such, you know, we're going to have a physical protest. And so it was really quite powerful in that sense. You really saw that very powerful interplay of the digital, you know, so agenda setting, but also information sharing. So protest is often met with, what's the word, like, not discomfort perhaps, but people see protest as being inconvenient, you know. And especially in the South African context, there's often that narrative of protest as inconvenient, you know, like, now I can't go to campus. I think when you came to Cape Town the first days, I texted them to say, well, there's some student protests, so maybe work from home today. I don't know if you can access campus. You know, there's often that narrative of kind of an inconvenience. You know, when we think about service delivery protests, for example, it's often reported as like a traffic disturbance without much context about the protest. Like, oh, there's a protest, don't drive here, don't go there, don't come to campus, students are protesting. And the digital in this case, I think, was really useful because it gave that context. It allowed people space to share stories about their personal experiences and why they felt uncomfortable with the Rhodes Memorial. So it really created a platform for personal storytelling. I mean, Papa Charisi talks about kind of the effective nature of social media and how it's the space for both individual and collective storytelling, and the power of telling, using the term telling stories, quote unquote, quite loosely, but sharing experiences. And so you really saw the online movement of hashtag Rhodes Must Fall building a lot of support for the protesters, because it created a platform for people to tell stories, for people to debate and discuss what was actually happening on the ground. Mm-hmm. So in terms of your question, I think, yeah, absolutely. You very much see that very strong directionality, digital to offline. Mm-hmm. It was quite powerful.
Yes, it's super interesting. It reminds me a lot about like how the Arab Spring revolutions were actually talked about. Like, that this is kind of a pattern, actually, that people who are confronted with a hostile environment in terms of the protest goals actually use these. Like, we had an interesting talk at the colloquium for the PhD students there lately. And they brought up the concept of interstices. Mm-hmm. So I feel like this is kind of that, you know, like there is this space which is not regulated in any way, or at least in no meaningful way for the ends of the protests. So there's also space to develop new forms of activism, new forms of expression.
Absolutely. New forms of activism, I think. And what's interesting about the new forms of activism, I think, is that it crosses existing boundaries, barriers, you know, so it cuts across the boundaries that you have in real life. Even decades after democracy in South Africa, it's still quite a segregated society in some way. You don't have many offline spaces that allow people with different political views or different ethnicities, races, gender, class, particularly, to come together to have conversations. And Twitter really created that space where students or people that might never have talked to each other or encountered each other in offline space actually came together in online space to have conversations about difficult topics.
So maybe also on the note of the influence of the digital on the physical world, this might be a great spot to actually talk about your project a bit.
So in our project, we are very interested in how digital media changes queer life and queer culture in Berlin and in Tokyo. And I have read some chapters of your book on everyday life on social media in South Africa. And there comes in some kind of a third phenomenon, that the digital influences physical life, and that the physical life is somehow mirrored or replicated in digital space. You wrote about how queer Cape Town is displayed on Instagram, for example. Could you tell us a little bit about this Instagram phenomenon? Because when I read this chapter, I had the impression it is rather imagination, how a queer place should look like, but it is probably very different, especially from the perspective of Black people in South Africa, how queer life really happens in the offline world in Cape Town.
I mean, I think the problem with visual media like Instagram is that it's so highly and heavily curated. People are posting images, which is kind of storytelling that represents what they believe things should look like, as you say. But I think it certainly creates a space for something like that, for the visualization of queer identity, you know, for example, because you don't have that really in any other form of media or in other spaces. You know, South Africa is very progressive when it comes to the legislation. So same-sex marriage, for example, is legal. African countries generally are very conservative. Even just recently, you would have heard about the quote-unquote anti-homosexuality bill in Uganda, for example. You know, it seems bizarre, really, in 2023, but it's not that unusual in African countries. And so South Africa is quite different in terms of having very progressive legislation that was already written into our constitution in 1994. But at the same time, it is still quite a conservative space. You know, we still do have the persecution of people of color who are not straight or gay in society in various forms, in very violent forms as well. So the Instagram story of queer Cape Town in some ways is quite a romanticized version of what it means to be part of the LGBTQIA community in the South African context. But at the same time, it's also really powerful because it creates space for the creation of that kind of identity. You know, it allows the possibility to exist for people who are gay. And I think that's actually really powerful. I also think it has quite a potentially powerful knowledge sharing potential for people who are quite conservative and who don't, the word understand is again not quite the right term, but who don't understand that there are different ways of being. And so not so much on Instagram, but I'm starting to see this very much on TikTok, for example. So if I could just say a few things about TikTok maybe and my observations there.
Please.
Okay, and not really grounded in any concrete research yet, but it's something I'd love to do research on. As you know, Eric, when I talked to you about kind of this idea about a paper on TikTok and queer identity in the South African context. So we know from other research that, you know, TikTok has played a really important role in multiple spheres in terms of people's personal self-identity, you know, so this notion that people often say things like, I didn't know I had ADHD, or I didn't know I was depressed until I started following TikTok, or, you know, and similarly, people coming out later in life or even earlier in life, I didn't know that I was gay, didn't know that I was queer until I started watching queer TikTok, or, you know, so kind of that interesting notion, you know, that people live in contexts that do not allow space for certain formations of their identity. And then they observe social media posts that create for them a different frame of reference about ways that they can be in society, you know, and that could be anything. I mean, sexuality is just one example of that, you know, it could be anything from, you know, personality or mental health or, you know, but all the way across the continuum to actually sexuality. I'd need to do more research into this, but I see that in the United States context, in the North American context, for example, there's a big TikTok community around trans identity, for example, and people sharing stories of whether it's, you know, starting the process of medically transitioning or stories about their experiences with surgery, etc. And what's really interesting to me, I'm starting to see in the South African context, is something quite similar. So despite quite a lot of transphobia, I think, in our society, there are a few TikTok users who are starting to post about their process of transitioning. And, you know, this is really interesting because when you start to look at those comments, there's a lot of like hate speech in the comments, you know, people saying really terrible things that show that they really do not understand. And the one or two users that I've started to look at are taking a lot of time to explain what it means for them personally and in a broader context, what transitioning means, to talk about gender identity and what that means, and in many ways to kind of deconstruct like a very heteronormative notion of what it means to be male or female, you know, and teaching people actually about the difference between sex and gender, you know. So that's really interesting that it's actually starting to play some kind of educational role around not just sexuality, but also gender identity. But of course, that's just observations, really. But yeah, so I mean, coming back to your question about Instagram, I think Instagram is a romanticized vision of what queer Cape Town might look like. It's more like an ideal and doesn't always translate into reality. But having said that, it's also really powerful because it creates a space that makes it possible to be queer, creates a space for the formation of community. People find other people through Instagram hashtags or through Instagram posts. It's used for advertising events, queer events and safe spaces for people and so on.
It's actually super interesting because I was thinking about your Brownback lecture like a couple of days ago, and there you came to a very similar conclusion from my perspective that Instagram is this very polished and advertisement space.
Yes.
And what you were talking about TikTok right now, it sounds like that's more experiential and like it's more about like what's the symbolic in a sense of like analogous experiences that people can relate to that, and that Instagram rather is a place for advertisement and for like polishing things, showing like the bright side.
Yeah.
And Instagram is not that analogous experience, but the aspirational experience.
Yeah, I think that's a really great insight. And I think your comment, Simon, has a lot to do with like the affordances of the platform.
Mm.
Instagram being still images mostly. I mean, of course, we know that they're transitioning to reels and the short video format as well. But the affordances of TikTok are such that it's more, even if it is super curated, it comes across as being quite natural and spontaneous because of the short video format. It's often the idea of just someone speaking to their audience from their bedroom, you know, as opposed to somebody going somewhere to find a pretty picture to put on Instagram. Mm-hmm. So I think you're absolutely right that Instagram has this more aspirational kind of feel, whereas TikTok, I don't know whether it's true, but whereas TikTok feels like there's greater authenticity, or at least in terms of developing that relationship between the poster, the person who posts, and the audience, it feels like a much more authentic relationship, which like lends itself to these kinds of conversations around gender and sexuality.
Yeah, and TikTok from the beginning on was a site of experimenting with your videos and putting music on the video. And so you never had this feeling that it is just documentation of life. But right from the start, it was a field of experimenting with social reality and your identities. And
exactly. And I think what's special is those affordances. So things like Stitch, for example, where you don't only see this with queer identity that I talked about, but you also see this with like a disruption of normative roles. Mm-hmm. So often somebody posts something that is perceived as being quite misogynistic, perhaps, and a user will stitch it and say, like, what is this nonsense? You know, like, oh my gosh, what are you saying? So you see a lot of those kinds of stitches. That's one affordance that's definitely a little bit different to Instagram in terms of how it's been used. And then, of course, the main difference that I see with community building on TikTok is that it's not follower-based. So, you know, you're not following people that you know, or you're not following specific users, but you're following a kind of community that's built around content. We don't really know how the algorithm works, of course. It means if you have an interest in a particular topic, it's going to give you more and more content around that topic. It's not limited just to the people that you know. Mm. It's a different function. We talk about the Twitter networks or even like the Instagram networks that are like follower-followee networks. Mm-hmm. And that makes TikTok potentially quite a powerful space because it brings users into contact with communities they might otherwise in the real world, in the offline world, not have come into contact with.
I would like to use the talking point about the experiences as as a segue, because experiences is something that is very close to my project, actually, because Airbnb posits itself as this platform that sells experiences.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't sell flats, but it sells like the unique experience of having this beautiful Airbnb at K Point, for example.
Yes.
And a huge part of that is like how to mediatize the place and how to describe the place in like this advertisement on the platform and how to represent it. And you work on a paper where you dove into this direction, not exactly this, of course, but like from a similar perspective, where you talked about how certain spatial social inequality is represented on social media platforms. Would you like to talk a bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think in that case, we were looking at how debates around gentrification, for example, are taken up by activists in social media spaces, and really just like unrealistic representations of the city, social media images representing gentrification, but not representing the social inequality that comes alongside that. So you have expensive apartments that look very nice being built in parts of the city as a way to attract more middle-income people to live there. Mm-hmm. But there's no representation of the people that are then kicked out, that are shifted out of those neighborhoods because they can no longer afford to continue to live there. Mm-hmm. I think it's quite interesting how kind of the spatial inequality of the city starts to be, you can really start to map that, I think, in through digital space by seeing like where people tag, location tags, you know, when people post. So I've written, for example, about Cape Town or Joburg, and when people use those city tags, where do they set the location? Mm-hmm. It's usually in a very particular section of the city, you know, so you really start to see how that highlights, I guess, the spatial inequality. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know if that's really what you were getting at or if that's what you meant.
It was just like a point to get into this direction, because I was very interested in, like you said, you can map out like where people tag the places, and I was interested in what kind of places were tagged actually. Airbnbs are in Cape Town at least. Located mostly in the city bubble.
Right.
Then you've got like a cluster around at Sea Point, which is like this, it's a beautiful seaside suburb. But my colleague from the project did some interviews with like housing activists there, and they were talking about that the Sea Point used to be like a less segregated area than other parts of central Cape Town. But that these people have been driven out by gentrification efforts like since the early 2000s. And I was wondering if you actually can see like this development in these areas, or if it's like kind of different.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it needs more quantitative research. That's your area, Simon. Maybe you can come back to Cape Town and help me with that. So it needs sort of much more data, but on the surface of it, yes, absolutely. I think the mapping that you've done with Airbnb, if you superimpose that on Instagram, it's going to be pretty much identical. And that's because, as you pointed out earlier, Instagram has that aspirational aspect. So yeah, I'm in a pretty place. Yeah, I'm in a middle income or a high income neighborhood or restaurant. Look how cool I am. That's very much kind of the narrative around that. And it's also linked maybe to, I mean, globally, there's been research that looks at people's shift away from news media. And there's kind of this notion that people don't want to hear negative news anymore. And that's why whenever people are interviewed about why do you not listen to the news or why don't you read newspapers, they talk about wanting to move away from negativity. Mm-hmm. And Instagram then almost starts to feel like an excessive positivity. You know, it's showing the pretty pictures and the positive side. It's not showing the spatial inequality. It's not showing the poverty. It's only showing kind of one side of things. But I think that's because it's aspirational. So people post pictures of themselves in particular types of spaces that are middle income or high income because it has this aspirational notion. When I bring it back to the personal, you start to think like how much of this is strategy, you know, what is strategic and what is something to do with the way that people behave, whether it's in online spaces or in offline spaces. I think there's a lot of room probably for the quantitative work, so the kind of mapping work that you do. But I think there's also room for qualitative work that is more interdisciplinary with disciplines like psychology that really starts to look at people's behavior and motivations for posting online. But yeah, the short version in answer to your question is really that I think if you look at your mapping of Airbnbs and you think about Instagram and you superimpose, they're going to be superimposable. It's going to be pretty much the same in terms of geography between City Bowl to the seaside area with no reflection of the, as you pointed out earlier, the challenges of gentrification in a place like Seaport.
We talked quite a lot about your empirical research, but recently you started to draw more methodological conclusions and lessons from the research, and we would love to hear about your ideas on decolonizing digital methods. So question would be, what are digital methods from your perspective? What is your concept of digital method? Is it big data, or what do you see? What do you think are digital methods? And the second thing is how to decolonize these methods. So there, we probably all agree that there's a need to decolonize these methods, but how to do it? That would be great if you can tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, that's a big question. And I guess to start with, I use the term digital methods like super loosely, really just to talk about researching the digital space, which could be anything from whether it's websites or any online platform, social media platform, apps, etc. And increasingly started to see very much the role of computational methods. And it's easy, well, not anymore with changed API restrictions, but it used to be quite easy to create, for example, a big Twitter data set. We had over a million tweets in the original Fees Must Fall data set. But, you know, many scholars, Boyd and Crawford, beginning with Boyd and Crawford, and then which was way back to present day, have kind of criticized big data, you know, that while it's useful, it can give answers or show patterns that you might not have thought of originally. It's also not always realistic or representative. And I think, so especially in the Global South context, you know, there's always this tendency to think about Global South spaces as case studies. The Global South seen as a place where you extract data. Data comes from the Global South and theory is built in the Global North. And I think this idea of decolonization is thinking about ways in which we begin to shift that. How do we build theory in the Global South and not just use it for data extraction? But coming back to big data briefly, just to say one way that I've thought and discussed with colleagues about decolonizing that is mixed media research, you know, which of course is more time consuming, maybe more expensive, but we really have to think about ways to do offline work, ethnography, interviews alongside the digital work. And I'd love to share a story which maybe reflects terribly on my own practice, but I think is really useful as a kind of learning point. And that's my later research on Fees Must Fall. So after Roads Must Fall, we had the surge of like the hashtag campaigns, and then you had hashtag Fees Must Fall. And somewhere in a book chapter, I wrote this paper that talked about the role of Twitter again in that student fee protest. But then a little bit later, I was involved in a research project with the Human Sciences Research Council that was more multi-method, where we actually interviewed activists. And in some ways, it started to debunk a little bit what I'd previously written. And that was really great, actually. It was super exciting because I started to realize that, okay, Twitter was really important and influential. And I said some really useful things. It was interesting to analyze the tweets. But actually, the activists were using WhatsApp a lot for their internal communication. Mm-hmm. They were sharing documents on Google Docs, literature on Google Docs, and policy documents and framing documents were being written collaboratively on in spaces like Google Docs. They were using Facebook for more detailed debate. And those were closed Facebook spaces. Of course, I didn't have access to as a researcher, people's personal accounts. But you really saw that there was a much bigger digital ecosystem than just Twitter. But you wouldn't know this until you actually interviewed people. So just kind of like telling the story to make a case for the mixed methods approach. It's easy to make assumptions about what's happening in a country or in a space by just looking at the digital conversations. And maybe this comes back to like Instagram and TikTok. I think the next phase of my research really has to be talking to these users, talking to people and asking them why they post in the ways that they do or what they hope to achieve in the ways that they do. So I think the two big key things for me around decolonizing digital methods are just that, you know, not relying only on the data, on big data, on online data and computational methods. I think those are fantastic. But I think we have to think about integrating qualitative research alongside that. So kind of thinking about different ways methodologically to approach questions. And then the second part, I don't have a clear vision for how this will unfold yet, is for us not to think about the Global South just as a space to extract data, as a space for as case studies, but to think about Global South also as a space for possible theory generation. I'm not sure how it is for European researchers, but I know that often when I meet like North American researchers at conferences and we talk about like what they're researching, like, oh, they're going to write a book on blah, blah, blah in America, you know, and I'm like, oh, that's interesting. But whenever I submit a paper or a book proposal, like I would like to write about blah, blah, blah in South Africa, the critique is always like, how is that relevant to the broader? You have to make that relevant to a broader context. You know, it's not interesting enough to write about, you know, one country. You have to position your work in a, whereas often people in other contexts don't really have to do that, you know. So maybe just re-shift the way that we rethink about space and different spaces and the contribution that research in those different spaces makes to kind of like a global body of knowledge. And that's about power and hierarchy, you know. As an African researcher, you occupy a different space in the global north hierarchy of research and publishing. And maybe that's, I mean, I know I said I had 2 points, but maybe a third point around decolonization is to shift the power dynamics. And so that started to happen, like journals are shifting what the editorial boards look like. They're shifting the ways in which they accept or reject articles. There's a lot of now pre-review, so giving authors feedback before sending a paper out to reviewers if you know that it will probably be rejected. So things are shifting, at least in the media and communication space. But a big aspect of decolonization, and again, I don't necessarily have the answer to it, is changing like who speaks. I don't have the reference handy. I'm sure you can look it up. But there was a recent journal article published, actually, and I'm talking only now about communication and media studies. It was a follow-up by the authors of the initial controversial paper that was called hashtag So White. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that. And it was kind of follow-up research where the majority of papers were still published by people in the global north, by males, you know. They were still published by people who would describe themselves as being white, not people of color. So you still have huge power discrepancies in the publication space, you know, and we have to think about ways to shift that, ways to be activists, you know, in terms of the ways in which we engage with journals and international book publishers.
I feel there's like a lot of focus on like the structural part of things, which is of course like really important, because if the structures are not accustomed to post-colonial research, there's no space for it basically. But what I would be interested in as a global north researcher who researches on the global south is what kind of practical solutions can we do in our daily work actually?
Like
your recommendation for us to reflect opposite and positionality within research, not to go to South Africa, just extract data?
Exactly.
Do you have any thoughts on that?
I think you're already doing a lot of good stuff. I mean, I think you're doing the right things, and the right things are that you don't come into a context with preconceived notions, but that you actually talk to people, which you've done. I mean, I think this has been a great, the Berlin Cape Town academic kind of exchange, almost informal exchange or relationship, has been really fantastic in that way. That, you know, a conversation like this, for example, the fact that we are recording this podcast, I think steps like that, micro steps in our conversations in Cape Town with you and Christina, you were both very aware of your own positionality. So I think you already have taken quite a lot of important steps towards shifting that power dynamic. You didn't come to Cape Town and act as though you had all the answers and that you were the experts. You came very much with like a growth mindset. You came to learn and you had conversations with people. I think that's the most important thing, really, is talking to other people, conversations on the ground, getting the opinions of others. Already, Eric, we've talked about you're coming to Cape Town in November. And so that was great. You know, I've met your team. I gave some personal views. I'll connect you with local people on the ground. So those are really important steps. You might not have thought about it as decolonization, but in fact, you really were doing that by having a conversation with me, and then I will link you with others who are on the ground so that you don't come in as kind of the expert global north researcher that has all the answers, but you're actually taking a lot of direction from the people on the ground. And maybe just one more step would be, and I don't know whether you've thought about this, like with the Airbnb research, I think is to share your research with, and it doesn't have to always necessarily be with the interviewees, but it would be great if both of you, when your projects come to completion, would give a guest seminar via Zoom, of course, unfortunately, to our department, for example. So I think in the dissemination of your findings, you don't just publish your work in an international journal or write a book that probably might not make it into our library or mm-hmm. be read by people, mm-hmm. but that in the process of writing up your paper, you actually give presentations to universities like ours in the Global mm-hmm. South, where people can say, oh, but Simon, you didn't think about mm-hmm. this, or why are you using mm-hmm. that outdated theory? And okay. you can rewrite then yeah. bits of your paper yeah. before you publish it. So maybe just one kind of addition, but I think the center's already doing great work.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Kim, any closing remarks from your side?
Well, thanks very much for having me. This has been a really illuminating conversation because I think it really raised some issues for me as well, especially around decolonization and taking things forward. And it was great to see you in Cape Town, and I look forward to seeing you in Cape Town. And I hope that we can continue, even if it's informally, this kind of Berlin-Cape Town research exchange.
Yeah, that would be great, actually. Again, thanks for participating in this podcast. Also for me, it has been very illuminating in regards to your research and in regards to your methodological approaches and thoughts. We as a CRC actually can profit from this kind of ideas. And I think we need to listen to these kind of ideas.